bit of danger of this antenna if you put your head super close to it and run reasonably high power because of this double concentration characteristic. I'm saying be careful with this antenna. Maybe I'm being overly conservative. I'd rather err on the conservative side than the nice conservative side, if you know what I mean. I don't want you...
Repeater, time out.
What I'm really worried about here is that brain material has not a very good temperature sensing. In other words, the tips of your fingers, you touch something hot, you know about it right away. If the center of your brain becomes hot because of something you've done, and there might not be a temperature sensing circuit there, you might not know it. But you take any portion of your brain material and raise it above 107 degrees Fahrenheit, you're at the threshold of doing permanent damage. But be careful. Yes, the good news is that your brain has got a significant amount of thermal inertia, specific heat. Just like whenever you're doing any kind of microwave exposure, you always integrate for 6 minutes because the most sensitive eye portion of microwave exposure is the human eye, and the human eye has got a time constant of around 6 minutes. So how much RF energy you put into an eye for 6 minutes determines what temperature the eye is going to go to. And you exceed a certain temperature of that cornea, of that lens, and it's nice clear material, and you're going to fog it. You're going to create a cataract. Well, in the case of this particular antenna, if you ran real high power, this loop antenna, and you put your head real close to it, and you run key down for a significant part of length of time, and you heat up the center of your brain material above 107 degrees Fahrenheit, and you might not know it, I think you can do damage. It's a comedy of errors required to do that. A significant number of minutes of key down power, a significant number of watts, and a significant amount of closeness if you mounted putting your head in the middle of this antenna. You do that combination, I think you can get yourself in trouble. Anybody got any comments on all of this slightly scary subject? K2RAW in the TechNet.
TJIS, I'd like to know what this implies for usage.
Okay, you said you would like to know
current.
You'd like to know what this applies to current something usage. Okay. You guys who have run this antenna QRP, don't worry. But if you decided to start using vacuum variable capacitors, great big transmitting grade capacitors, so you can put 100 watts, 500 watts, 1,000 watts into this antenna, I do not recommend you put that antenna at the edge of the bench where you've got the Morse code key and you're only a couple of feet away from it. My gut feel is you better keep yourself more than 5 feet away from this antenna if you're putting any significant power into it. Maybe you're overly conservative, but you can see I'm a little bit worried. Anybody have any further comments on this? K2IW in the TechNet?
Cell phone and using cell phones close to your body.
Okay, the IEEE ANSI, ANSI is American National Standard Institute, the IEEE American National Standard Institute C95 report represents approximately 60 years of study of the RF exposure of human beings and what is dangerous. The bottom line of all of that is that with reference to cell phones, you go to the right website, you can find out what is the specific absorption rate for the usual use of every brand and every model number of cell phone that you can buy. So the American standard on that, I think it's 2.5 watts I've forgotten the volume, but it's 2.5 watts per, let's say per meter, per cubic meter of biologic material. The specific absorption rate is an exact number that's printed for every cell phone. That number, which is the threshold of alarm, was arrived at because of how much local heating a cell phone will give you. And the good news is that these cell phones, they only run a fraction of a watt most of the time. Let me drop. A fraction of a watt of an antenna that's mounted a quarter inch away from your head creates a measurable amount of heating. That measurable amount of heating is something like a fraction of a degree Fahrenheit of increase of the nearby material. And because there's such a prodigious flow of blood through that head of yours, and because the total number of watts is so small, that automatic cooling system can handle that very well. So all of the evidence to date is that a cell phone is safe. However, we all are scared to death of a cell site. Think that that great big chunk of hardware, 100-150 foot high tower, half a million dollars worth of hardware, great big antennas on top, boy, that looks formidable. And you buy, as you've probably heard me say so many times, you buy the house that you can get that's the closest possible to a cell site, right next door. And on the second floor of that house, in your bedroom, at that window, you're facing that cell site, and you make a measurement at drive time, at rush hour, when the cell site is cranking maximum power output. And you make a measurement right at that window as to how many watts per square meter is hitting your body. Make that measurement, and you do the calculation, you'll find out that the cell site, in that worst-case condition, is giving you 1 million times less power into your head than you would get with that cell phone in your hand mounted a quarter of an inch away from your head. I didn't say the cell phone is dangerous. All I'm saying is that the cell site is 1 million times safer for two reasons, three reasons. Number one, let me drop the closest you can possibly get to that antenna is a slant range of roughly 200 feet. Comparing inverse square law, 200 feet versus a quarter of an inch. On top of that, the antenna is 100 foot high, and it's got an antenna pattern that's a pancake pattern aimed at the horizon. So the pattern is aimed above you, the antenna is mounted above you, and the 200 feet of slant range between you. The real dangerous distance of a cell site. You've got on the local fire department's hook and ladder, 100 foot high, and they back the fire truck up to the cell site as close as you can get, and you're on the top of that hook and ladder. And you're now exactly at the altitude of that antenna, and you're 5 feet in front of that antenna during drive time, during rush hour. And you're staring straight into that antenna with your eyes open for 6 solid minutes. Believe it or not, that worst-case environment I just described does not exceed the maximum permitted exposure by U.S. and European standards. Move into 2.5 feet, you've now crossed the line. Now you're at the threshold of danger. 5 feet is safe. And you've got a whole bunch of towns on Long Island, Hempstead Town, Huntington Town, Oyster Bay Town, saying that for new cell sites, they're not allowed to be mounted any closer than 500 feet to a place of worship, to a school, or a place of residence. You ask yourself, where the hell did that 500-foot number come from? Let me drop. It came from the fact that Hempstead Town hired an expert who I think is in Florida. The expert was smart enough to say, he said the words that they wanted to hear. He recommended 500 feet. That made them happy. He knows damn well that every new cell site, the best location they can choose is going to be 241 and 321 and 180 feet away from one of those things. They're going to go back to the guy and say, is that safe? To which he said, well, you give me some money and I'll do a little more study and I'll find out if that's safe. He knew what the answer was ahead of time. He knows 5 feet is safe. But he's guaranteed his new salary. Every time somebody wants to put a new site, they're going to go back to him and ask him again that question. Crazy business. The fact that the people who ordered that particular consultant to do that work for them, they had very little understanding of the C95 report. They didn't bother digging into it. When he came up with a number, nobody asked him where the hell did that number come from. They weren't smart enough to ask that question. From their point of view, they had done their job. They hired an expert. He gave them an answer. And they didn't question the answer. So there's a huge amount of misunderstanding going on here, as you can tell. Are cell phones safe? Yes. Are they safe by a million-to-one ratio compared to a cell site? No. But we've studied specific absorption rate of cell phones. They've come up with numbers as to what is safe. All of the evidence is that it is safe. Whenever you try to measure, let me drop. You can do a double-blind test. You can have a whole bunch of volunteers, and this test did take place. You can have a bunch of volunteers holding cell phones against their head, doing telephone calls. Some of the people are using an inert cell phone, the audio is getting to the cell phone by some other means, and others are using a real active cell phone. It's a double-blind test. And when you do the double-blind test, what you find out is the people running the real cell phone, if they happen to be doing mental calculations at the same time, mathematical calculations, the ones with the real cell phone can do the mathematical calculations a little bit faster. When you heat up brain material a fraction of a degree Fahrenheit, it operates a little bit faster and can do mental calculation a little bit faster. That's the only real confirmed measurement change that has been measured with a cell phone. As I said, I think they're safe. If you want to be super conservative, then you'll use a speaker mic on the telephone and you'll hold it away from your head. But I don't think you've got to do that. Anyone have any further questions or comments on all of the above? You're hearing a whole lot of opinions, and so is it all traceable to the Bureau of Standards? Well, by way of the C-95 report, to some degree it is. K2RIW, listening.
Dick, that's the comment. Dick, I have a question. For the droop antenna that we discussed, how can you make this antenna to have a very high current on it? As we see from that big loop, it's made from the very thick tubing. So, you said there are places we're going to have a high voltage, but you can have also very high current, a number of hundreds of watts, of amps. Where is the place? How to achieve it?
You didn't do anything to achieve it. You built an antenna that's a small fraction of a wavelength in dimensions. Therefore, by definition, by the Q-Wheeler criteria, it will have high Q. Anything with high Q has, by definition, a large amount of energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. When the energy dissipated per cycle is a fraction of a watt, and you're going to be putting into there 100 watts of apparent stored energy by way of the current you measure on the coil, the inductance of the coil, one half Li squared is the number of joules that are stored during that half cycle. And by the same token, you can measure the voltage, RF voltage on the capacitor. One half CV squared tells you the number of joules of stored energy in that capacitor on that half cycle. And the energy is bouncing back and forth between the inductor and the capacitor. That's what resonance is. So you've got a huge amount of energy bouncing back and forth on each cycle. But only 1/100th of it is being radiated. That's what the Q of 100 means. So if you're putting 100 watts into it, and 100 watts is being radiated, but 10,000 watts is being stored on each cycle, by definition, the current has to be high, the voltage has to be high. Made an antenna small. You've made it low loss in the materials you've used. By definition, the Q will be high. Therefore, you know exactly what ratio you're going to be getting of stored energy per cycle versus dissipated energy per cycle. It's physics. You didn't do anything fancy with that loop to make it high in current, other than the fact you made it a small number of wavelengths in length or a small number of wavelengths in diameter. That forced the Q to be high at that frequency. There's no other way around it. Somebody had another question. What was that other question? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
Repeater. Time out.
Hey, I'm sorry keeping you this way. I just want to rephrase and make sure that I understand it properly. The reactive...
Let me go to that. Okay.
10 kilowatts. However, the reactive power is not dissipated, but it corresponds to the power delivered by the power stored in the reactive component, which would be inductor or capacitor. That would happen during the semi-cycle, in the next half cycle, or the component where the component returns to the stored energy to the source. So you could have a 10,000 watts, and it would be our reactive power that is bouncing back and forth. Is that correct?
You've got it, Wes. At the instant the voltage is maximum on the capacitor, 1/2 CV squared tells you how many joules are in that capacitor. At the instant the voltage is maximum in the capacitor, at that instant the current in the inductor is zero. A quarter of a cycle later, the voltage in the capacitor goes through zero, while the current in the inductor is maximum. 1/2 Li squared is the stored number of joules in the inductor. On each quarter cycle, capacitor has all the power, inductor, all the reactive energy, and the inductor has none of it. A quarter of a cycle later, the inductor has all of the energy, the capacitor has none of it. And so the energy is bouncing back and forth between the capacitor and the inductor. That's what resonance is. And now you know the amount of resonant energy, you know the amount of peak voltage, you know the amount of peak current, you know the amount of stored energy. So the fact that that's a great big number is significant, but only a small fraction of that is being radiated. That's what IQ means. So we're not doing anything special here other than starting off with an antenna. Let me drop. Once you have chosen an antenna that is small in wavelengths of dimensions and length, you've chosen an antenna that's small in wavelengths, and you've chosen to make it out of very low loss materials. So it's not going to be burning up your reactive energy by heating up a resistor somewhere. So if it's not heating up a resistor, but yet the stored energy is high, definition by the Q being high, because the dimensions are small, you've done all the right things to make a hell of a lot of stored reactive energy. Be a little bit careful, because that stored reactive energy is periodically making a great big magnetic field and a great big voltage. That great big voltage could burn you if you put your fingers across it. And that strong magnetic field, if you put your head in it, can be heating in the brain material. And if you're running 100 watts, if you're running 1 watt out of a cell phone and you put it a quarter of an inch away from your head, that's relatively safe. Run 100 watts into a loop antenna and put your head in the middle of it, boy, are you pushing your luck. You do that for 6 minutes, and I think there's a chance you can do damage. So all I'm saying is that treat this antenna with a healthy respect. If you're putting a lot of power into it, don't put it close to you. Keep it at least 5 feet away is my gut feel, and you can do some further calculations as to what's the right distance. The fact that 5 feet, as opposed to a quarter of an inch with a cell phone, that 5 feet is a lot of inverse square law, if you know what I mean. And the energy is being radiated by this antenna in a lot of directions at once, and by the time it's a quasi-isotropic antenna, and by the time you're 5 feet away from it, you're probably safe. If you want to be super safe, you make it 7 feet, but don't run a whole lot of power and put it super close. There was another person that had a question. Who was that? Give me your call letters again. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2J, yes, I had an observation. Quickly, I've seen cell antennas, or what I thought are cell antennas, on very tall apartment houses, and I was just wondering how safe they were. The occupants living below the roof. Antennas, by the way, seem to be mounted on the parapet.
Yeah, the best way I can answer that one, Roger, is that in the case of the most significant situation we've got on Long Island, in the township of Oyster Bay, in the town of Bayville, that town has for the last 4 or 5 years been attempting to remove every single antenna from that town. They're positive that all these antennas are creating cancer. They started that rumor, and they've supported it among each of the members of that town. And so you can go to their website called BRACT, B-R-A-C-T, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. And they've gathered all the worst information they can find on all of the really bad websites in the world about how dangerous RF energy is. And it just so happens that in their particular case, all these antennas are on top of a water tower, and the water tower is directly across the street from the school. Example I gave, let me drop. If a child ran out of that school, ran across the street to the water tower, climbed over the chain link fence, went over to the water tower, climbed up the ladder on the side of the water tower, got up to the parapet, get up to the veranda or the balcony around the water tower, then climb up the ladder on the water tower itself, go to the center of the water tower where the antennas are located, kneel down in front of that antenna, stare directly into that antenna 5 feet away during rush hour, calculate the number of watts the antenna is radiating, calculate the maximum permitted exposure and whatever. If the student kneel down in front of an antenna 5 feet away from it and stare straight into it, by United States and European standard, he is safe. He is below the maximum permitted exposure. If he moves into 2.5 feet, he will exceed the standard. at 2.5 feet, he will be above the maximum permitted exposure. And if he did that during rush hour, and if he did it with his eyes open for 6 solid minutes, he's at the threshold where he might, if he's very sensitive, he might develop a cataract. But at 5 feet, sitting there all day long, he's safe. Of course that sounds crazy, but that's the real numbers you go through. You study the C95 report. I didn't say it's easy. Study the C95 report. Let me drop it. You will come to that conclusion. So now my question is, you've got these cell site antennas on top of the apartment building. How many of those... My question is, how many people in that apartment building can get within 5 feet of the direct bore site of that antenna and stay there for 6 minutes? I know the answer to that question. How many people have the ability to get within 5 feet or less directly in front of the bore site of that antenna that's on the roof of that building? K2JAS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roger.
K2JAS, I believe you answered my question. I was just concerned about the fact that if you're living in the room underneath that antenna, I would assume that by the length of time that you're there and the frequency of the cell tower signal, I had some reference. But you've answered the question. Thank you.
Now, K2M, you recognize, but stand by a second. There's another important point here that you should know about, and that is, in the case of nuclear radiation, and because we call it RF radiation, that crazy xenophobic word, radiation, it should have been called radio transmission, radio signaling. We should not have called it RF radiation. But because of the way nuclear radiation works, it is accumulative. Give yourself 3 millirems of nuclear exposure today and 3 millirems of nuclear exposure tomorrow, you had close to 6 millirems of total exposure. The body does a little bit of a repair overnight, therefore the numbers don't completely add. But in the case of RF exposure, which is non-ionizing, and it is not accumulative, you expose a person to 10 milliwatts per square centimeter of RF exposure today, and 10 milliwatts per square centimeter of RF exposure tomorrow, his total exposure is 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. It does not add. Whether or not you got any damage from RF exposure is a function of how much heating did you create. As long as the amount of heating you created, and RF energy, when it hits a human being, they haven't measured anything other than heating. They're looking for the non-thermal exposure, non-thermal effects all of these years, and can't find it. Let me drop it. So, the fact that you've got, what's the word I'm looking for now? Non-cumulative exposure with RF energy. As long as each one of those exposures was below the maximum permitted exposure, that's a fancy way of saying you didn't heat the human being's tissues to a number that potentially can create damage. As long as you didn't exceed the heating number today, and the fact that you've done the same amount of exposure today and tomorrow does not accumulate. It's sort of like saying that I'm heating up my hot dog today by 1 degree Fahrenheit, and I'm heating up my hot dog by 1 degree Fahrenheit tomorrow. And if I keep doing that long enough, am I going to cook the hot dog? Not a chance in the world. That's sort of where we are. I wonder if it makes a little bit of sense, Roger. K2JAS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Beautiful answer. Thank you. The other station, NY, pick it up.
Yeah, the new station that just signed in. I've forgotten your call. Give me your call and your name, sir. K2RIW.
Evening, Jack in the TechNet. This is K2MU Bernie. Listening in. I'm very close to a cell tower myself. I'm sure I don't feel like it's a problem. I wanted to ask you, though, about Wi-Fi. I have met a number of people that claim to be sensitive to Wi-Fi. I don't know the regular rate. If you think it's just some kind of imaginary thing or claim that it affects them. Back to you.
Yeah, we had a fair number of dropouts there, Bernie, but I think I got the nature of your question. That's it. you've got a friend or you've got know some people who believe they're getting an effect from Wi-Fi. I also have a friend, it happens to be the friend I visited tonight, who is absolutely positive. He can sense the magnetic field coming from the ballast transformer of a fluorescent light. So he makes sure that there's no fluorescent lights in his house because he thinks he senses the magnetic field that's in that shielded can of a fluorescent light. I can't be positive he's wrong. He's been running various tests throughout his life, and he believes he has that sensitivity. He believes it gives him an uncomfortable feeling, and the extreme case, it gives him headaches. So the fact that you have a friend who believes he has that sensitivity, you can't say absolutely positive it's not true, but I can tell you that by way of the approximately 60 years of measurements that have been done by the IEEE C95 report, National Institute, well, I keep forgetting the name of the organization. Hey, John, what's the name of the organization that supports the C95 report? American National...
ANSI?
That's it, American National Standards Institute. They've been doing 60 years of study of the effects of RF radiation on human beings and other animals. And so they can't find an effect. As long as you're below the maximum permitted exposure, which used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter for a number of decades, and now to be super conservative, they've lowered it to 1 milliwatt. And you might ask, where did the 10 milliwatt number come from? Somewhere around 1945 or so, I'm not sure of the exact year, they literally took a rabbit, clamped him into an exposure, and clamped him in this, a fixture that held his eyelid open. And they started exposing his eye to RF energy. And step-by-step process, they finally found out that around 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, they could eventually give him a cataract under that worst-case condition. No human being would tolerate that. You put anywhere near that number of milliwatts per square centimeter into the face of a human being. Let me drop it. You put that number of milliwatts per square centimeter into the face of a human being, he's going to feel the heat on his face. And he's going to turn his face away. He's going to blink his eyes and whatever. So even at 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, the chances of you doing damage to a human being are very slight. But for the first few decades of the C95 report by ANSI, American National Standards Institute, they set a number of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. They assumed that by a 10-to-1 ratio, it's going to be safe. Because under this worst-case condition, they had to really work at it to give this rabbit a cataract. And they assumed that the eye damage of a rabbit and the eye damage of a human being are similar. And you and I could argue about that a little bit. But because of a bunch of people complaining that that's not good enough, in order to be more conservative, particularly for a situation where the exposed public is not being informed. So if you're not being informed, as opposed to being informed, they've set the number as low as 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. So in theory right now, almost anything you do, if it's meeting the standards of the ANSI report, you're not being exposed to more than 1 milliwatt per square centimeter. If you and I try to calculate the amount of heating of human tissue at 1 milliwatt per square centimeter, I don't know the exact number, but if we did do the calculation, we might come to the conclusion it's 0.01 or 0.05 degrees Fahrenheit of heat increase. Well, that's an extremely small fraction of the heating you get when you lay in the sun on a summer day in your bathing suit. You lay on the beach, that sun can give you 1,000 watts per square centimeter, about 1,000 watts per square meter. Your body has a little bit more than a square meter of area to it. So you could be getting 1,000 watts of thermal energy from that sun. If you're not wearing the right kind of sunscreen material, and the ultraviolet exposure from the sun near high noon is probably going to give you a sunburn. And maybe a
repeater, timeout.
And maybe a lot more tan than you like. But the human body, you could say, through the zillions of years of evolution, has been tuned to tolerate approximately 1,000 watts of thermal input from the sun. Under normal circumstances, with the right conditions, we survive that very well. So some number of milliwatts coming out of a cell phone, can that damage a human being? Very unlikely. Are the people that are sensitive to it, where they can sense the power out of a cell phone, or they can sense a Wi-Fi what's the word I'm looking for? Can you think of the name of the damn thing? A router. Can you sense the power coming out of the router? Can you sense the Bluetooth circuits that we use in the house? Can you sense the energy coming out of your handheld controller for the television set and the garage door opener and so on? And even if you can sense it, it's now all of the evidence is that you have to exceed some number of significant number of milliwatts per square centimeter or watts per kilogram. That's the word I'm looking for, kilogram. 2.5 watts per kilogram, I think, is the European standard, and I think it's 2 watts per kilogram is the American standard, and evaluated to the nearest cubic centimeter. But 2 watts per kilogram with normal human material, with normal blood flow through it, has an extremely good cooling capability where it's only going to get a fraction of a degree Fahrenheit of increase in temperature, and it's got a small fraction of what you're going to get with lying in the sun. And because the most vulnerable part of the body is the eye, body is the eye, and the eye has got a 6-minute thermal time constant, just turning that thing on is not enough. You've got to be continuously exposed for 6 solid minutes above some number before you can measure before you can encounter a measurable effect.
Repeater, timeout.
And I told you earlier what that first real confirmed measurable effect is. The rate at which you do mental mathematics. They haven't measured any other effect, per se. Yeah, a couple of testing laboratories thought they saw some kind of an effect. And when another laboratory repeats the experiment, they don't see the effect. So when you're looking for something right at the threshold of whether or not it does have a measurable effect in body chemistry, reproductive action, and whatever, it's not easy to do. But there's a ridiculous amount of safety factor built into that standard. We're right now running 100 times lower than the amount of power that can create damage to a rabbit when he's clamped into a fixture and he's being irradiated by a crazy amount that would immediately he would feel the heat and he would run away from it. No human being would stay there for that exposure, if you know what I mean. So I think almost all of the RF stuff that we're worrying about is nowhere near as dangerous as you think it is. The problem is primarily a problem of xenophobia of a word, radiation, RF radiation. You sure should have called it RF signaling, RF transmission. Perfectly good word until nuclear radiation came along in World War II, and now we associate the two. Nuclear radiation really has subatomic particles flying out of that event at near the speed of light, and when those bullets, those subatomic bullets, penetrate your body, they do damage. There is no particles to RF energy. It's a photon wave. It's a wave that has a heating characteristic. That's what happens in your microwave oven. Let me drop comment. I heard the word comment. I'll pick you up in a second. And that is, I'm a member of the Long Island IEEE Consultants Society, Consultant Network of Long Island. And one of the members there, who happens to be a computer maven, asked me the question one day. When I nuke my food in the microwave oven, those are the exact words, when I nuke my food in the microwave oven, and I turn off the oven, and I take the food out, how long should I wait for the half-life of that radiation so that the food is safe to eat? Here it is. Because it's RF radiation, he assumed there was a real nuclear effect and there's a real half-life. How long do I have to wait? My answer was less than a microsecond. Before you can open the door, when the magnetron is no longer getting any voltage and it's no longer putting RF energy into that microwave oven, there's no longer any energy there to worry about. And the energy that was there was doing nothing but heating your food. It wasn't changing the chemistry of your food, other than the normal chemistry change you get when you put it in a thermal oven and you raise the temperature of the food. The RF energy hitting your food creates thermal energy of the water. That's what cooks your food. And does the microwave energy of a microwave oven make your food more dangerous than if you cook it in a thermal oven? All the evidence is the answer is no. So if it doesn't irradiate your food and damage your food, then by what mechanism is it going to be damaging your body? As long as the temperature created is below some ridiculously small number, then there's no confirmed measurement that RF energy can create damage. A person with comment, give us your full call, then, sir. K2LAW, my name is Dick.
K2JAS again. What do you say to the police officers who claimed some kind of damage from using their radar guns, or was it that they kept them in their laps and their groins or whatever? And what do you think about the transponder in my aircraft putting out 200 watts per sweep cycle from a radar station on the ground? How dangerous could that be? I certainly don't feel any heating. K2JAS.
Yeah, I'm going to go in reverse order. The transponder, the IFF transponder, is putting out pulses of a few microseconds each, maybe milliseconds. It's a very brief pulse. Lots of people will look at a radar, for instance, and they'll measure the peak envelope power of the radar, peak pulse power. They'll measure the peak gain of the antenna. They'll multiply the two numbers together and say it's dangerous. RF energy creates no effect on a human being other than heating energy. Heating energy is a function of the average power, not peak power. Of course, to the point where you're not arcing over the air in front of the antenna. If the antenna is running so high in power that you're arcing over the air in front of it, and you put your hand or your body in front of that antenna, and now the arcing is creating ozone and high voltage arcing, yes, you can do yourself some damage. You're not going to do that. But other than that, peak envelope power doesn't matter. Average power is what creates heating. And it's the average power over a 6-minute period that you're concerned with. Your IFF is putting out an extremely low duty cycle pulses, very brief pulses. It's spending 99.9% of the time off the air, even when you're being swept with that radar. And now you can also ask the question, what about the radar? Well, your aircraft is X number of miles away from the radar. And if you calculate the first mile of RF energy falls off by roughly 90 dB at the VHF frequencies, and your radar is even higher frequency where it falls off faster than that, the first mile is 90 dB of attenuation due to free space effects. So is that radar, if that radar wasn't sweeping, let me drop it. If that radar was boresighted and continuously staring at your aircraft, and as long as you're more than a couple of hundred feet away from that radar, you're safe. You're a hell of a lot more than a couple of hundred feet from that radar, and it's not staring at you continuously. It sweeps by you once every 12 seconds, if you know what I mean. So that can't do it. So your IFF is safe. Your router is safe. Your Wi-Fi is safe. Your microwave oven is safe as long as it's being used in the conventional manner. Your fluorescent lights are safe. Your handy talkie is safe. But for you to make any of these things unsafe, boy, you got to do a whole lot of double and triple errors as I see it. Back to you on that one, Roger. K2JAS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. What about the police officer with the radar gun?
Yeah, the old-fashioned X-band Doppler radar system that measures speed of drivers, it put out something in the vicinity of 200 milliwatts, that gun. And so there were policemen claiming that when a guy came by speeding, they would aim the gun out the window, and the rest of the time they didn't want them to see that they're running this gun, so they put the gun in their lap and aimed it into their gonads, was the claim. Many of those guns had a trigger to them, that you aimed it out the window and you pulled the trigger and it made a reading. It didn't run continuously. So for the policeman to claim that he put the gun into his lap, aimed it at his gonads, because he didn't want somebody outside knowing that he's making that kind of a measurement, and that it was in the pull trigger mode and continuously operating, and even though it's running a couple of hundred milliwatts, could a couple of hundred milliwatts out of an X-band horn aimed directly at your gonads, could that create enough heating? I doubt it. Not impossible, but boy, that's a triple comedy of errors. aiming it directly at that sensitive part of your body, doing it for more than 6 minutes at a time with the trigger pulled, and I think a few hundred milliwatts is not going to do it. I don't think it's enough power. It's getting close, but I don't think it can do it. On top of that, the amount of energy that your gonads can tolerate is considerably greater than what your eye can tolerate. We already know what the eye number is. I know that the gonad number is considerably higher than that. There's a lot more blood flow in that area that can do the cooling. So I think that they made a good sounding case. Let me drop it. They made a good sounding case. They had a good lawyer. The judge wasn't sure. The judge made a decision based on very little information, so to speak. Not too different from what happened in Reims, France, about a year or two ago. Maybe it was 3 years ago. This was reported in IEEE, Antennas and Propagation Society. I think it was the June issue last year. In the back of the issue, they talked about what happened in Reims, France. There was a cell site erected alongside of an apartment building. And the people in the apartment building were getting headaches, nausea, difficult sleeping, trouble concentrating, upset stomach. They were getting all kinds of medical conditions. And they started putting tinfoil against the windows that were on the side of the apartment building toward the cell site. And they're doing all kinds of things to protect themselves. And they created a lawsuit. The judge, looking at the lawsuit, said, we can't really confirm that the presence of that cell site is creating all of this grief. But because there's such a large number of people in this apartment building all claiming all of these medical conditions, for the time being, I'm going to make this decision. I'm going to order that that cell site alongside of that apartment building be removed. And she made that decision. The people operating the cell site, the actual technicians installing it, said, this is crazy. We hadn't installed the antennas yet. It wasn't operational, and now we're being told to remove it. It turns out that they saw this great big structure alongside of their cell site, alongside of their apartment building, and they all developed these huge psychosomatic illnesses, and they all convinced each other how sick they were. That whole report, as I said, was in an issue of IEEE Proceedings, Antennas and Propagation Society, in the last...
Repeater, time out.
In the last year or so. Beautiful report. That gives you a little bit of a hint of what's going on here. K2JAS, I wonder if you heard that story before, Roger. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2JAS, that is so beautiful. I haven't even installed the antennas yet. I love it. What about, on the same vein, but talking about living somewhat high tension power line? Whatever became of that that low frequency but very, very high voltage field in that area. Back to you, KTJAS.
The latest few versions of the C95 report of American National Standards Institute, it used to be some number of megapsychs up to 300 gigahertz was the frequency range of the report. The report now goes down to 60 hertz. So at 60 hertz, that report has E field rating, H field rating, and milliwatts per square centimeter ratings. So the report goes there. And you take those high tension lines, you take the distance that a habitable house is near one, and you also look at one other very interesting thing. If you and I were making a transmission line to feed RF energy to our antenna, and you want it to be a very high efficiency transmission line, you and I would use open wire line. 600 ohm, 450 ohm open wire line. We take a pair of 14 gauge pieces of wire, we put them in the right spacing, which is probably around 3 inches apart, and we make a whole bunch of plastic insulators to support the wire 3 inches apart across the whole length. At HF frequencies, that's an extremely low loss transmission line, which does not radiate because those two wires are an extremely small fraction of a wavelength apart from each other, and it's being used in a thoroughly balanced manner. Let me drop. In other words, when you're feeding that transmission line the correct way, with the right kind of a balancing device, with the right kind of antenna tuner that's made for feeding twin lead or open wire line, at the instant that the right-hand wire is positive, the left-hand wire is negative by the exact same amount on that half cycle. So the thing is thoroughly balanced and has extremely little radiation. As long as the spacing between the two is a small number of wavelengths, and as long as it's being used in a balanced manner. And there's nothing magic around two-wire balanced antenna transmission line. You could make it with three wires if you want to. Instead of feeding the two wires 180 degrees out of phase, you feed the three wires 120 degrees out of phase for each one. That again would be a balanced, thoroughly shielded transmission line, even though it's open as all hell. You could space those three wires 3 inches, 4 inches apart from each other, have this kind of a birdcage that holds those three wires, and you feed those three wires with 120 degree difference. It's a thoroughly shielded structure, and even though your head is a foot away from it, you're not going to pick up any RF energy because it's not radiating. It's a balanced structure. It cancels itself locally, if you know what I mean. Most of the high tension lines are built as a three-wire system. The three wires have three voltages on them 120 degrees out of phase. And I guarantee at 60 hertz, where the wavelength is some zillion number of miles, and these wires are only a small number of feet apart, as long as you feed the same amount of voltage and current into those three wires 120 degrees out of phase, it is a balanced, non-radiating structure. Let me drop it. You go near that structure and you try to measure the magnetic field or the E field from it. You'll have great difficulty measuring it. As long as they're using it in a balanced manner. I sort of will admit that if one of the phases failed, and they wouldn't continue using it, but if one of the phases failed, and now you're using the other two wires, and they're not 180 degrees apart, they're only 120 degrees apart, which means you've now got a common mode component, there, under that condition, you would be able to measure some voltage, you would be able to measure some local H field, magnetic field. But when those three wires are being used in the conventional manner, that's an extremely well-shielded structure. It looks open as all hell to you and my eye here, Roger. That's a very well-shielded structure electronically because of such an extremely small number of wavelengths between those wires being used in a balanced manner. You see what I'm getting on that one? K2JAS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2JAS, I'm sorry you weren't able to hear me applauding you. I really thank you for that beautiful, beautiful commentary. Back to you, Nick.
Hey, John, we've got a happy customer there. We've got to send him a bill. Okay, we're way beyond the point where we should have gone over the mailbag. And, John, don't take me seriously. Don't send him a bill. He's a happy customer. KC2WGB with the mailbag, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone in the net. All I know, Dick, is I've learned now, when I pop the popcorn with my cell phone, I'll stay far away from it now. Let me let it drop my monster first.
And I hope you guys know that YouTube video where these people are sitting around a table with cell phones and popping popcorn, and there's three different versions of it. One version is a bunch of Oriental people. One version is a bunch of Scandinavian people. They change the clothing of the people, but it's the exact same table and the exact same popcorn and whatever. They eventually admitted that was a phony characteristic. The whole thing was phony. If you wanted to pop popcorn, by the way, you can have a lot of fun by taking your local piece of popcorn in the bag that you're about to put into the microwave oven, and you take it apart, even after you've used it, if you pop the popcorn, and you take the thing apart, you'll find out that there is a black piece of material in the bottom of that bag which sucks up the microwave energy, turns it into heat, and the heat of that black substance inside of the bag is what pops the popcorn. You almost cannot pop popcorn in a microwave oven without the local heating device. The individual kernels are too small in wavelengths at 2.4 gigs. They don't absorb enough of the energy. You wouldn't pop the popcorn. So it's really that black piece of material that's inside of the paper if you take it apart. Interesting experiment. Go do it someday. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Also, most popcorn is extremely dry, not much moisture in it. So it must be a little special popcorn that you use in microwave ovens. All right, let me let it drop it once, this first one. Well, evidently, Bill, AC2IS, was listening to last week when we were talking. construct here, and he wants to know if you can give him a calculation on this. Drop again. Okay, we have two isometric antennas separated by 29 centimeters, transmitting antenna, 30 dBm per square meter. What would you measure on the receiving antenna, 29 centimeters? And these are isotropic antennas. Back to you.
Yeah, there's a couple of funny unknowns here, John. First of all, there is no such thing as an isotropic antenna at RF frequencies. There are antennas that are more isotropic than others, but true isotropic you cannot achieve for a whole bunch of technical reasons. Question number one. Question number two, he thinks the first antenna is issuing 30 dBm per square meter. True, maybe. How the hell did he make that measurement? And that measurement only has meaning if you tell me the range of the measurement. If I measured 30 dBm per square meter 1 foot away from the antenna, that's a nice reading. And if I now move from 1 foot away to 6 inches away, I might measure more than 36 dBm per square meter at that new range. So how did he make that measurement? At what range did he make the measurement? Without that information, nobody can make the calculation he's asking for. He's making a very logical question, but the raw data looks spooky. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech man.
KC2WGB. Absolutely, Dick, I agree with you. Didn't say if it was near field, far field. I have no idea the distance. But let's assume, talking about 30 dBm input to the antenna. Now we have an antenna 29 centimeters in distance. Now, I know that he had also mentioned the reciprocity of the receiving antenna retransmitting a reflected signal, and so I had to filter this out in that total question, and this is what I believe he's asking. So let's try it from an input of that 30 dBm to that antenna. Maybe that would help.
Good guess, but no. Free space loss is the formula I can give you right now. Free space loss equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. I'll repeat that. 36.6 plus 20 times the log of F plus 20 times the log of D. F is frequency in megahertz. D is distance in miles. Add it all together and you come up with dBm of free space loss between two truly isotropic antennas. Let me drop. Notice that one of the biggest factors in that formula is the frequency. He didn't tell us what frequency he made the measurement. He didn't tell us what distance he made the measurement. He didn't tell us how he got to 30 dBm per square meter. There's more unknowns than knowns here. But he can answer the question himself with that formula I just gave you. That answer is in decibels of free space loss between a pair of isotropic antennas. So once you know the distance in miles, and by the way, 29 centimeters, it's an easy calculation to find out what fraction of a mile is 29 centimeters. And so you're going to be putting in an extremely small number into that formula for the 20 log of distance, 20 log D. And it looks like a crazy calculation. It comes out right. Don't worry. What I'm getting at is, if he was really doing it at a microwave frequency, like, let's say, for instance, 5 gigahertz, 29 centimeters, because I've done that. I've done something close to it. 29 divided by 2.54, because I live in the inches world. Okay, I got the numbers in the calculator. 11.4 inches, almost a foot. And I was getting 30 dB of loss at 915 megacycles for 3 feet. Probably going to be in the vicinity of 20 dB of free space loss. Very rough guess, plus or minus 5 dB. And you can plug it into the calculator, the real formula, into a real handheld calculator. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout.
KC2WGB. WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, maybe I didn't interpret the question correctly, or maybe you'll reissue another question with a little more nation so that I can present it for you. In any event, let me go on to the next one, and we'll deal with that when it comes to it. KC2WGB, let me let it drop. Okay, I have a young man here with a Yagi antenna, 440. What has happened? A tree branch fell and broke off some of the directors. Now he has purchased new material, aluminum tubing, which will slip over the old existing studs perfectly. What a... And he doesn't know what to do. Should he drill them and use nuts and bolts, pop rivets, conductive salve? What should he, how should he put that together to guarantee some good continuity? And he's going to cut them to the correct length. He's got five directors and three of them are damaged.
Okay, so I know it's a 440 Yagi. Do you happen to know how are the elements mounted? You talked about the stubs. That implies that the elements go through the boom, they broke off at that boom, at the edge, and now he wants to extend those, as opposed to replacing the whole thing. In other words, he could remove the thing that's through the boom right now and replace it with a similar diameter piece of tubing. That would be the right way. Try to reconnect stubs of aluminum. Strongly don't recommend that, because no matter how you put them together, I don't care if you use the world's best conductive epoxy, I don't care if you use aluminum welding, you're eventually going to build up aluminum oxide, and a couple of milliohms of a million of aluminum oxide in the conduction near the center of a director will make a measurable decrease in the performance of a Yagi. How well the center of that element is conducting to the two ends, so to speak. You are sensitive to milliohms of change. So I strongly recommend you do not sister it or try to plug something in over the stubs. I strongly recommend, if at all possible, you replace the whole damn element with a continuous piece of aluminum. A continuous piece of aluminum, no sweat. You break it into pieces and you try to make it act like one electronically at 440 megahertz. With aluminum and the rate at which aluminum oxide is built up with outside ultraviolet exposure. Boy, let me give you a good example of this. Let me drop. Starting in 1972, the Ed Tilton Yagi, the 13-element Yagi of Ed Tilton, a man who was the creator of the World Above 50 Megacycles, a column in QST Magazine, W1HDQ, I think it was called, it's W1HDQ. I've talked to Ed Tilton. Way back in 1964 on 6 meters. And I met him face to face when I published the article on the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier. He was at a conference I was at. He literally ordered me to visit him at his hotel room. He wanted to see the man face to face that came up with that piece of hardware. And he said some very nice things to me. But he wanted to see that man face to face. Let me drop it. Okay, so the state-of-the-art of Yagis in 1972 was the Ed Tilton 13-element Yagi. Each of these aluminum rods, I think were 1/16 of an inch in diameter, went to a 1/2-inch diameter boom. The 13-element Yagi was, I'm not sure of exactly, but I think it was in the vicinity of 8 feet long, 13 elements, with all the elements going through the boom. Okay. A buddy of mine was taking down 4 13-element Ed Tilton Yagis that had been on his tower for a couple of years. And because I had just set up my backyard antenna range, or a ratio, I think it's the odd issue. Anyhow, you go to the QST archives, look up K2RW, you'll find the outdoor antenna range, ratiometry antenna range, outdoor improvement technique. Let me drop it. So I have this outdoor antenna range where I have the ability to resolve gain to the nearest 20th of a dB, 0.05 dB of gain difference I can resolve. I didn't say that's the absolute accuracy. I'm talking about the gain difference that I can resolve. And one by one, I put these 4 Yagis on my antenna range. And I measured differences of gain of 2 and 3 decibels between the four Yagis, which is